characters in this dialogue, Laches, well, there are five participating characters and two onlookers. Lysimachus and Melisseus are the sons of two extremely prominent Athenian statesmen, generals, and their two sons, who are named after their own fathers, or the Lysimachus and Melisseus's fathers, are present too. Lysimachus is the son of Aristides the Just, and Melisseus, the son of Thucydides the General. And these were two of the greatest leaders at Athens' apogee, its peak. And they have their two sons there and with them, along with Nicias and Laches. And Nicias and Laches were two very prominent generals during the Peloponnesian War. The setting of this dialogue is sometime between 424 and 418 B.C. We know this because it refers back to the Battle of Delium in 424 B.C., and Laches died in 418 B.C. At a different battle. So we know it's sometime in that six-year period when Socrates is in his 40s. What Lysimachus and Melisseus are complaining about is that their fathers did not teach them statesmanship, and that they did not rise to the great public heights that their fathers rose to. And this, they think, is confirmation of the claim that Socrates makes in his Meno, that's also cited by Theages in the Theages, namely that if the great statesmen of Athens had an art that made them great statesmen, surely they would have taught that art to their own sons, yet they didn't. So Lysimachus and Melisseus are good fathers, and they're absolutely determined not to give their sons the same disadvantages that their distinguished fathers gave them. So they are trying to give them the best possible education that they can arrange. And the attitude towards it is stated near the bottom of the first page, where Lysimachus says, "Well, we've decided to take the best possible care of them now that they've become young men, and not to do so, and not to do as many people do, to let them do what they please, but especially at this point to begin to take care of them so far as we are able." They're not going to allow the kids just to do what they want. They're going to force them to do the right thing, to bring them the best possible position in society. And so they've invited these two generals, Nicias and Laches, to a martial arts exhibition. And it was an exhibition of fighting in armor. And after the exhibition is over, they turn to the two generals and they ask if they could please advise them whether or not signing their sons up to learn how to fight in armor would be an element of a good education. And Socrates is also along. And the opening passages here are very interesting because what they try and conjure up is the full rot of Athenian political life during the Peloponnesian War. So let's just read a few select passages. Melisseus says, "You've seen the men fighting in armor, Nicias and Laches. Melisseus here and I didn't tell you at the time why we invited you to join us in watching, but now we will. For we believe we should be frank with you. Some people scoff at things like this, and if you ask their advice, they don't say what they really think, but guess at the advice you want and speak contrary to their own opinion. But we believe you are sufficiently knowledgeable and will say simply what seems true to you. That is why we ask your advice in the matter about which we intend to consult you." So, first of all, they know that truth is not regarded very highly in the society at the time, that people are willing to flatter and lie rather than speak their minds frankly, and that this is the norm. This is what people have come to expect, and this is why they've had to seek out these people, and they're trying to basically butter them up to get their correct and honest opinion. And then he goes on, "Well, the point I've been leading you up to by way of this long preamble is this," and one of the things that's very interesting here is the preamble is enormously wordy. He just rambles on and on and on. It's a practical filibuster. "We have these sons here," and he introduces the sons. Then he tells about their attitude towards education. He goes on after that passage I read earlier, now where it says B in the margin, "Well, we know you to also have sons, and we believe that you, if anyone, would be concerned about how they might be raised to become most excellent. But if, after all, you haven't paid much attention to this sort of thing, we remind you that it mustn't be neglected and summoned to you to exercise care for your sons jointly with our own. And then he continues to go on and on and on down the bulk of the next page, 62, before he finally pops the question. And Nicias says, I approve of your plan, Lysimachus and Melissius, and I'm ready to take part in it. I suppose Laches here is too. You suppose right, Nicias, says Laches. Now that these two characters have been introduced, let's talk a little bit about their background. They were chosen very cleverly by Socrates. And there's a lot of sort of subtle, dry, typically British or Platonic humor here. Nicias was the engineer of the famous Peace of Nicias, which lasted for 1 year during the Peloponnesian War. Later on, he was the leader of the second Sicilian expedition that the Athenians sent out, and this expedition was utterly destroyed, and it was destroyed under the leadership of Nicias. The choice to put Nicias in charge was done by the Democratic Assembly, and it was done in a purely political manner. He was a highly respected general, but he was known for being dilatory, cautious. He was a political general. And they put him in there to counterbalance the leadership of the impulsive Alcibiades. So they figured, in their wisdom, that one group wanted the impulsive Alcibiades, the other group in the assembly decided, well, they could accept that as long as they canceled out Alcibiades with an equal and opposite sort of general. And so they sent the expedition off under the control of actually three generals, the first of whom died fairly quickly. And then it fell into the hands of two people who could not work together and make decisions, and the whole thing was a colossal disaster. This is committee decision-making and compromising at its worst. And the disaster of the Sicilian expedition was the turning in the war, after which point all of Athens's fortunes declined until they eventually were completely defeated and their empire was destroyed, and Greece has never really recovered since then. Nicias is a pivotal figure in history. Nicias was a very educated and very intelligent man. There's no question that he's an educated, intelligent guy. He's a real gentleman, and he makes excellent points here. He reasons very well. There's another characteristic of Nicias that comes out here, and this is the characteristic that ultimately undid him in his leadership of the Sicilian expedition, namely that he's superstitious. He takes seriously soothsayers. After the initial defeat suffered beneath the walls of Syracuse, the third general died, and it was necessary to retreat. They were beaten, and they had to get out of there. But unfortunately, there was an eclipse of the moon. And this is the kind of thing that sends superstitious into paroxysms of fear. And so what Nicias did is he decided that before he could decide on what to do, he had to consult soothsayers about the meaning of the lunar eclipse. And this process took so long that they didn't make their retreat in time, and they were just soundly beaten. The other general who died before Syracuse, Lamachus, he's mentioned in here, and he was an extraordinarily brave Athenian general. When the Syracusans attacked, Nicias was killed along with many of his other men, and it was left to Alcibiades to salvage what was left and return home. Nicias was a pivotal figure, a superstitious yet highly learned man, the product of the best kind of education that was available at the time. No one in Athens could fault him in any way. He was sort of an Ivy League educated, highly political gentleman. Now, Laches is a different guy entirely. He's a crusty old general. That's the only way I can put it. He's crusty but benign, to use the cliches of the television industry, right? He's sort of the old Professor Kingsfield type. He was a, sort of a plain-spoken guy for the most part. He wasn't a very good reasoner. He wasn't highly educated. And he was just a little bit corrupt. In the first Sicilian expedition, which he was put in charge of, He fought very bravely and distinguished himself on the battlefield, and then when he came home was investigated for embezzling funds from the army. And interestingly enough, it's Laches who defends the claim that virtues are not all the same, that you can have one virtue but not all the others, okay? Which seems something that Laches would defend, right? He might have the virtue of courage, but he doesn't necessarily have the virtue of honesty. And the kinds of arguments the two men give seem very much in character. And Laches' arguments are kind of laughable in a way. In a way, though, you have to say that Laches, at least I think, has a better grasp of what courage really is than Nicias, even though Nicias is the better, more polished reasoner and the guy who can follow out what Socrates has to say better. So what happens at this point, let's go to page 64. You have two speeches, one by Nicias and the other by Laches, and this is just like the Athenian assembly. And these two fathers have these two generals stand up, and they each make a speech for or against fighting in armor. Since they're undecided, one of the fathers says, well, we need a tiebreaker. He's not going to make up his mind. He's going to go with the majority vote. So they bring in Socrates to break the tie. And again, there's something comical and preposterous about this form of decision-making. And Socrates is purposefully trotting this out as a kind of parody of exactly what went on in the Athenian assemblies and law courts at the time. So let's look at the speech that Nicias makes. Skip the first sentence of Nicias' speech. Indeed, I think this study, namely fighting in armor, is beneficial to young men in many ways. For one thing, it's good for them not to spend time elsewhere on things young men like when they're at leisure. It keeps them off the street, sort of like after school programs, right, or midnight basketball. Keeps them out of trouble. But on this instead, okay, the body necessarily improves from it, so that's his second point, for it's in no way inferior to other bodily exercise or less strenuous. And at the same time, this exercise in horsemanship especially befit a free man. Okay, it's a liberal kind of education. It's the sort of thing that gentlemen do. Peasants don't have horses to ride, and peasants don't have armor to wear, and peasants can't afford someone to teach them to fight in it. This is the kind of thing that a gentleman, namely somebody who has money and leisure, does. For we are athletes in a contest, and in the matters in which we contend, only those are exercised who are exercised in the tools of war. Then, too, this study will also be a benefit in combat when one finds might in ranks with many others. But its greatest benefit is when ranks are broken and single combat is required, either pursuing someone warding off attack or warding off attack when retreating oneself. A man who knew this would not suffer at the hands of a single opponent, and perhaps not even of many, but everywhere gain the advantage. Again, this sort of thing calls forth desire for another excellent study. Anyone who learns to fight in armor would want to go on next to the study of tactics, the ordering of men in ranks, and once he grasps this and his ambition is stirred, he'll be eager for all that pertains to strategy, the art of the general. It's already clear that every study and practice involved in these subjects is noble and of great value for a man to study and practice, for which this study might serve as an introduction. I'll add, and it's no small addition, that this knowledge would make any man more confident and courageous in war, and by no small amount. Nor let us disdain to say, even if one thinks it less important, that it will also make him more graceful, where a man should appear more graceful, and in a place where at the same time he will appear more terrible to his enemies, by reason of his gracefulness. So for my part, Lysimachus, as I say, I think it should be taught to the lads, and I've said why I think so. But if Laches has something contrary to say, I'd myself gladly listen. Now, this is the speech of a gentleman, right? He's concerned with not only the practical considerations, but also the fact that it's noble, that it will increase grace, right? That it will orient the lads to higher forms and broader forms of study. It's well-reasoned. He just gives a list of reasons, and he explains them clearly. It's the product of an educated and refined mind. It's a pretty darn good argument. It's a good case. I would find this convincing. Now let's look at what Locke says. Locke's speech is much longer because he's not such a good reasoner. He rambles a bit. You have to sort of see the sort of bluff older fellow sort of getting up there, maybe a bit red-faced and explaining himself. Dionysius, it's hard to say of any study whatever that it shouldn't be learned, because it seems good to know everything. And in particular, the skill in arms, if it's really the subject of study, its teachers claim, and Nicias says. But if it's not a subject of study, and those who profess it are practicing a deception, or if it is a subject of study but not a very serious one, why learn it? He's not even sure that it's really a subject matter, which is a kind of odd thing. By what standard would one judge whether something isn't a matter of study, other than the fact that people study it? Clearly there's some sense here that it's not an accepted thing. It's not on the curriculum. He's sort of a conservative. He's the kind of guy who would say, ecology studies, I'm not even sure there is such a thing. Or women's studies, I'm not even sure there is such a thing. That's sort of the kind of objection that he seems to be edging towards here. It's not accepted. It's not traditional. And that alone casts a certain doubt or shadow over the whole thing. I say this with a view to the following. I think if it amounted to anything, the Spartans would not have ignored it. This is his argument. If it were any good, it would have been done a long time ago, especially by the Spartans who are up on these things, and it hasn't been done by the Spartans, so it must not be any good. This is a great argument for getting rid of any innovation, right? If it were really any good, it would have been done thousands of years ago. So the very fact that it hasn't been done before makes an innovation not worthy of consideration. Now, he does add to this the fact that the Spartans are authorities on these matters, so there's more substance to it than just saying if it were any good, it would have been done. Nothing else matters in life to them except to seek and practice whatever once learned and practiced gives them advantage over others in war. If they've ignored it, that very fact is something at least these teachers of it have not ignored, namely that the Spartans are in earnest about this sort of thing beyond all other Greeks, and that anyone honored by them in it would make much more money from the rest, as tragic poets do when honored by us. So this is another kind of element of it. It especially wouldn't have gone unnoticed, because if it were useful, the people who teach this would be rich. You know, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Yet clearly, the Spartans aren't paying these guys who've just put on their exhibition in Athens. And if the Spartans aren't paying them, right, then there can't be that much good to it. They'd already be rich, if this were any good. That's why anyone who thinks he's good at producing tragedy doesn't go on circuit outside the walls putting on performances in other cities around Attica, but brings his work straight here and performs it for this audience, reasonably enough. This is sort of another point, right? If it's any good, they would have taken it to Sparta first, not Athens, just like if somebody has a good tragedy, they go to Athens first, not Sparta. They're the people who judge. But I see these people who fight in armor believe Sparta is sacred and forbidden ground, not to be trod on even tiptoe. They skirt it and put on a show for everyone else instead, especially those who'd even themselves agree they have many superiors in warfare.
Is that true that their best fighters have been in Sparta?
But they probably didn't train them to fight with these elaborate martial arts type things, like this fighting in armor, which was somehow a new thing, and I don't know exactly what it would include. You'd think that they would all learn to fight wearing armor, so there had to be something more to it that just has been lost to history. We don't know what the connotations of it are, but it had to be something rather new and odd. Some new techniques of some new martial arts were basically being rolled out here. But the Spartans were, you know, they were big on military training. There's no question about it. And Locke's does have a point. If somebody really had an important innovation, they'd take it to Sparta first because they would be the ones who would recognize the importance of it. And even though the Spartans were loath to change things, if it was a genuine innovation, they would find some way of doing it. This is one of the characteristics of so many traditional societies, that if some really important innovation comes along, they'll find some way of making it traditional. They'll say, well, we've done this all along, or this was something that was prophesied 1,000 years ago by the great founder, or something like that. They will find some way of sanctifying some new innovation if they're pragmatic and not thick-headed. If they're Burkean conservatives, right? Burke said that institutions that lack the capacity to change lack the capacity to preserve themselves. So he goes on, and then he tells a sort of funny story of Stesilaus, who was some guy who was did all kinds of fancy new forms of fighting. And let me just read this. For instance, take this fellow Stesilaus, whom you and I watched putting on a show in that great crowd and boasting about himself. I watched him elsewhere under real conditions put on a better show, though not voluntarily. The warship he was serving on rammed a merchantman, and he was fighting with a sickle spear, another kind of weapon for another kind of fellow. I find that very funny. Well, the rest of the story is hardly worth telling, except for the bit of cleverness about the sickle attached to the spear and what resulted. As he was fighting, it caught somewhere in the tackle of the merchantman and got stuck. So Stesilaus pulled, trying to free it, but he couldn't. And ship was passing ship. So he ran along the side for a while, hanging onto his spear. When ship sheered off from ship and drew him with it, still hanging onto his spear, the spear pulled through his hand until all he had hold of was the end of the shaft. There was laughter and applause from the crew of the merchantman and the figure he made. And when somebody threw a stone at the deck by his feet, he let go of the spear, and at that point even the crew of his own trireme could no longer contain their laughter at seeing that sickle spear dangling from the rigging. Well, there's something in this, as Nicias says, but my own experience has been things like this. So as I said to begin with, it's not worth trying to learn whether it's a study of small usefulness or whether they claim and pretend it's a subject of study when it isn't. In fact, I think if a coward supposed he knew it, he'd only become more rash because of it, and his cowardice would become even more evident. But if he were courageous, people would be on guard against him, and if he made even a little mistake, he'd incur great prejudice. For pretensions to such knowledge arouse jealousy, so that unless one is astonishingly superior in virtue to the rest, it's impossible to escape becoming a laughingstock by claiming to have this knowledge. So that's about what I think of taking this study seriously, Lysimachus. But as I told you to begin with, don't let Socrates here go, but ask him to advise us what he thinks about the subject before us. Now, this is the speech of a guy who bases everything on experience, not on his fine education. It's not closely argued, but it's based on fairly practical considerations. Look, the Spartans know about this. If it was so great, they would have done it. Right, there's some merit to that. And the last argument he gives is kind of interesting. Look, newfangled fancy weapons and gadgets just make cowards worse, and they're not an advantage to brave men either. Because unless you're really superior, when you use some new technique or some new weapon, people are just going to be more critical of you. You're going to be more liable to slip up and become a laughingstock. Part of his concern is just having the respect of one's peers, which is kind of interesting, right? He's a man who's concerned with honor, understood as the approval of one's peers. And he's saying, look, from the point of view of simple honor, it's very important not to get involved in things that encourage envy, not to be too innovative, too newfangled, because people will just judge you more harshly, especially if you fail at it. There's something practical about that. So at this point, Lysimachus asks Socrates to break the tie. There's a little discussion that I think is very interesting and worthwhile. And that is about how you judge some new innovation. And what Socrates does to judge this new innovation is he says, well, look, what is the standard by which we judge anything? So let's look on page 67. At the very bottom of 67, the last line, he says, in a word, then, when somebody considers something for the sake of something, the counsel is about that for the sake of which he was considering, but not about what he was seeking for the sake of something else. Now, what is the point that he's really making here? if you look back on 67, just above that, he gives an example of a drug for the eyes. He says, of course, Nicias, he says, of course, Nicias, when someone inquires of someone about a drug for the eyes and whether or not it should be used as a salve, do you think the counsel is then about the drug or about the eyes? It's about the eyes. And if someone considers whether or not a bit should be applied to a horse and when, he's really taking counsel about the horse and not about the bit. And so he draws the conclusion in a word, when someone considers something for the sake of something, the counsel is about that for the sake of which he was considering, but not about what he was seeking for the sake of something else. What he's really saying is, look, if you're going to talk about the application of some new knowledge, ultimately you're going to have to talk about the person or thing to whom that knowledge is applied, not the purpose you have for applying. So, for instance, the doctor might have financial concerns with the salve, and that's the reason why he's dispensing it. But that's not a sufficient understanding or a sufficient basis for understanding why to do that. In order to know really why to do that, what the point of it is, you have to know the nature of the eyes and how they're benefited by it. The same goes for horsemanship. If you're riding a horse in a particular way and you want to know when and how to apply the bit, it doesn't matter why you're riding the horse or where you're riding the horse to, so much as what the nature of the horse is and how that affects it. That's the most important thing. But until you know the nature of the thing that you're applying this technique or this instrument to, you can't really even discuss how to pursue your aims or your goals. And so what Socrates is trying to do is he's trying to reorient the discussion away from the discussion of consequences and look to how the study will affect the students. So, for instance, if you look back at Nicias talks about how this has practical effects, clearly, but he also wants to talk about how certain things about this study are noble, and they might encourage new studies and so forth. But everything that he's really oriented towards is the effect. That's the argument that he's giving for studying fighting in armor. It'll have a good effect. Lockes doesn't think it'll have a good effect, because he thinks that if it would have a good effect, the Spartans would already have done it. And he also argues, look, these sorts of things are liable to make you a laughingstock, and therefore you shouldn't be too eager to learn newfangled things. That's, again, a sort of a concern with extrinsic effects, the effect that this will have on other people who are looking at you, your audience. But what Socrates is trying to do is he's trying to say, look, the real criterion for determining whether or not anything should be studied is the effect that it's going to have on the student's soul. Okay? And so he brings in explicitly the discussion of the soul. On page 68, where it says E in the margin, about 8 lines down. Well, we now claim to be considering a subject of study for the sake of the soul of these young men. Yes. So it must be considered whether any of us, then, is expert in the in service of the soul and able to serve it well, and which of us has had good teachers. Really, Socrates, Lockes says, haven't you ever seen people who become more expert without teachers than with them? Which is a good question. If everybody had to be taught by somebody else who already knew it, there would be no possibility of discovering anything for yourself. Yet everything that's taught has to be discovered originally before it's taught to somebody. And Lockes is making a good point. You know, there's got to be some way outside the teacher-student relationship. The actual discoverer has to discover new things before they can be taught. But Socrates wants to focus in on the question, are there any teachers? Are there teachers enough, good enough for the youth? And this is a theme throughout the entire dialogue. And at the end, the two generals, Nicias and Lockes, and the two fathers, are completely convinced that Nicias and Lockes are not qualified to teach the kids. And the generals are the first to admit it. And then they turn to Socrates and say, Socrates, why don't you teach them? And he says, but I don't know anything either. And we should all look together to find somebody who can teach us. And one of the assumptions that clearly seems to be operative here is the assumption questioned by Locke, is that everything has to be taught, that virtue has to be taught. And as it turns out, Socrates doesn't believe that virtue can be taught. This is one of the great, strange, paradoxical Socratic teachings. Virtue cannot be taught. And it has a number of meanings to it. The most obvious meaning is this. Socrates claims that we always already know what courage is, what justice is, what wisdom is, and so forth. We have this knowledge somehow latent in our souls, and that the process of education is not to pour virtues or knowledge of virtue into people, but somehow to draw it out of them by helping them articulate a kind of tacit, inarticulate knowledge of what virtue is that they already have. And in that sense, you're not teaching them anything by giving them information, but you are drawing something out of them. And that's clearly what Socrates does in a lot of dialogues. In the dialogues where there's actual progress, as opposed to the dialogues that we've looked at in this class, which usually end with people just being stumped and frustrated. In the dialogues, though, where there's actual progress towards greater and greater understanding of the topic being discussed, Socrates is depending upon the fact that these people have some kind of intuitive prior knowledge of what justice is or wisdom is, and he's drawing that out of them and helping them to articulate it. And then he'll get a particular definition, then he'll criticize it, and then they'll come up with a more adequate definition, and they keep moving towards a more comprehensive understanding of the thing. That's one way in which you don't teach virtue. Virtue is drawn out of us. There's another sense in which Socrates doesn't teach virtue, yet he still is useful to people. And that is something that's mentioned in the Theages, where Socrates starts talking about various students that he's had, and one of them said that he benefited simply by being in the presence of Socrates. And that he benefited more when he was closer to Socrates, when he was further away, and that he benefited the most when he was sitting right next to Socrates, touching him. This is a very weird sort of argument, a very weird sort of account, but what's going on there? Well, I think one of the things that, and this fits in with the whole drawing out of unconscious implicit knowledge theme that I've already discussed, Socrates is sort of a psychopomp. He's kind of leader of souls, right? One of the things that happens in certain relationships with guru types is not so much a teaching that's imparted as the provision of an opportunity for the person to somehow generate something from within. And one of the things that's interesting about Socrates is that he seems actually to be involved in what Freud called transference relationships, which is very peculiar. What is the transference of Freud? Well, Freud decided that he was a medical doctor, he was a scientist, and he was going to observe his patients with the same dispassionate distance and objectivity that an entomologist observes bugs, meaning that he wasn't going to have a personal relationship with them. He would just sit there and let them talk. And he discovered after a while that this simply wouldn't work. Because if Freud just sat there stone-faced out of their range of visions, he sort of sat behind them so they couldn't even see him, they would start projecting a persona on him. They would start treating him as if he were a person, but not himself, because they couldn't get to know him. They'd treat him as if he were somebody they knew, and it would usually be a very important person. And it might, according to Freud, and he came to believe that it was almost always the person who is most responsible for the problem, right? So women would start treating him like their father, right, or their husband, or their brother. And he would use these transferences, these projections that they would have in their relationships as one of his clues for trying to diagnose what was going on, to get inside their heads. And it's very clear that Socrates' silence leads people to project all kinds of things on him. this is why there are so many different Socrateses, because there were so many different imagined relationships that people would have with this quiet, strange guy. Yet at the same time, in spite of the enormous evidence that Freudian psychoanalysis is just as effective as keeping a diary or seeing a priest or not doing anything at all, the fact is that these transference relationships really did seem to have some kind of therapeutic value, because they would awaken things inside people, and again, it would be a process of somehow self-discovery would be going on, which is what happens when you keep a diary or you go for a walk in the woods or things like that. Put it this way, when you're not involved in the interpersonal interaction with somebody, which is often an occasion for you to put on a persona or a mask, but if you don't have that occasion, then oftentimes you sort of get behind the persona or mask and become more aware of who you really are. And finding occasions for that is helpful. Paying $100 an hour for it is probably unnecessary, though. Now, Socrates isn't just a silent witness. He asked questions, so did Freud. But he didn't give answers, and he pretended not to know things. And he wouldn't answer direct questions, he would only ask them. And this created oftentimes a great deal of insecurity and anger. But on the other hand, it did seem to be helpful, and this is why this fellow said that he could sit in a room with Socrates, silent, and he would feel that he was making progress in his education. And that the closer he sat to Socrates, the more progress he made. And when he wasn't around Socrates anymore, he wasn't making any progress and would actually go backwards. It's a very strange claim. There's this guru named Mother Mira. She could be a complete vegetable for all I know, because her entire guru routine is that she just sits in a room and doesn't say anything. And people go and sit, have a sitting with Mother Mira, and come out raving how she understood them totally. How she would give them a glance and they would feel totally affirmed and totally forgiven and totally aware of themselves. She's some Pakistani or Indian woman. Of course, we don't know anything about her because she's never said anything as far as we know in her entire career. But she gives people this feeling that they've suddenly put everything together.
Do you remember the Peter Sellers movie, Big Bear?
Yeah.
Keep reminding me of that.
Yeah, well, you know, what's his name, Chauncey Gardner in there? He's an idiot. But he's the kind of idiot who seems to draw up these transferences. So people think of him as wise and brilliant, women fall in love with him, he becomes president of the United States at the end, doesn't he? Or something like that. Or maybe I'm mistaking him for Ronald Reagan, I don't know. Or Al Gore, for that matter. But anyway, just to be bipartisan, Chauncey is just this blank slate, but there's something about him that invites these kinds of projections. Well, let's go into the discussion of courage. Socrates is really concerned here. Again, he establishes first that we need to talk about the soul, because it's the soul that gets educated. That's where the real changes take place in education. And he makes it very clear, and this is just sort of explicitly an attempt by Plato to defend Socrates from the charge of corrupting the youth, that we have to make sure that the youth are better in soul, because after all, if you corrupt them, that'll make people angry, and it won't be good for the youngsters either. So what Socrates then does is he talks about how, in order to educate people, to improve their souls, we need to impart virtue into the soul. And in order to do that, we need to know what the virtues are. And now it's very interesting that both of the speeches, pro and con, for learning how to fight in armor, mentioned courage and cowardice. And that is the virtue and the vice that is most connected with martial military matters. And so generals, of course, would appeal to this. And so the question then becomes, well, what is courage? That's the real issue. If you want to talk about some kind of martial arts education, and you're not just thinking of it in terms of what the effects are going to be on the battlefield, but in terms of the effect that it's going to have on the soul of the learner, then you're going to have to evaluate it in terms of whether or not it induces courage. Is less aware of the connection between the habituation to courage or cowardice of military education than is Locke's, who in his last argument talks about how these newfangled things will just make cowards more cowardly and they might undermine courageous men's ability. So at least Locke's is thinking in terms of the character effect of this in some vague way. So he's closer to the truth than Nicias. So Socrates asks Locke's for a definition of courage, and this appears on page 73. Locke's is a good old general, yet he immediately shows himself to be an inferior reasoner. And he says, in answer to the question, what is courage? This is a little above the center of page 73. Locke says, "Why, really, Socrates, it's not hard to say. If someone is willing to stay in ranks and ward off the enemy and not flee, rest assured he is courageous." That's the kind of answer you'd expect from a general, but it's got at least four flaws. Okay, first of all, it's not a definition, it's just an example. Second, one can retreat bravely, too. And it's already been mentioned by this point that Locke's knows Socrates personally because they were both in the Battle of Delium, where they retreated together, and that Socrates was distinguished by the courageous way in which he conducted himself during the retreat. So one can retreat courageously as well as stand one's ground courageously. And this is an example that's already been given, and it's not odd that Locke's doesn't see that this is just as much courage. Go ahead.
Do you think it is that it takes courage to retreat? Well, I know he says so, but I don't agree with it.
Well, it doesn't necessarily take courage to retreat, mm-hmm. but you can retreat courageously. There are two ways of retreating. One is just to flee headlong, in which case you'll be hunted down and killed. The other is to retreat in an orderly and self-assured way, which communicates to your pursuers that you probably shouldn't be trifled with because you'll fight back. That would be a courageous way of retreating. Okay, and believe me, you know, people can tell the difference between somebody who's retreating out of fear and somebody who's retreating because of the tactical necessity but still has their wits about them. And so the courage there is, in a way, simply maintaining one's wits, one's presence of mind. Socrates is described as trotting along, warily looking from side to side, communicating that he's aware of himself and he's not, he's in possession of himself. This is a description that's given in the Symposium, when Alcibiades, who's on the retreat with him, describes how he retreated. So one can retreat in a courageous way, too. Socrates points out that there is courage off the battlefield as well. And finally, this definition does not give us any clue as to what needs to be done to the soul in order to induce courage into it. And part of the reason why we're looking for a definition of courage is to help become courageous. And this example really doesn't give us any help. And so it's a fairly flawed attempt to answer the question. So at the top of 75, we get Locke's second definition. And this is a better definition because it is not an example, it is a definition. It doesn't just refer to the battlefield. You could refer to anything else, any place else. It does refer to the soul. And that's important, too. It talks about perseverance, which, of course, doesn't allow for the possibility of courageous retreat. Sometimes it requires courage to give up on something when it can't be done. You know, a lot of people will persevere in a bad course of action out of pride or folly because they don't have the courage to admit to themselves and others that it was a mistake and that it's time to stop. So that's a problem with it. And Socrates points out immediately that perseverance alone can't be good. It can't be a virtue. Why? Because perseverance can be foolish. Right? You can persevere out of folly. And Locke's immediately sees the point. He says, okay, well, I mean wise perseverance. Persevering when it's wise to persevere. And then Socrates says, well, there's some kinds of wise perseverance you wouldn't call courage. For instance, he gives examples of an investor, right, who perseveres in spending money on a particular thing, knowing that in the end he will get a greater return from it. He's patient, he's perseverant, he stays out the fluctuations of the market, he's not panicked and things like that. He perseveres. Would you really call that courage? Well, you might say there's a certain amount of courage, but really, just persevering in something doesn't necessarily mean you're courageous. It can also mean you're stubborn, even though it might be wise to be stubborn. He also then gets Laches to say, well, wait a second here. If you have two men fighting, and one is fighting because he calculates that it's best to persevere in fighting, and the other doesn't persevere in fighting because he's calculating it, but he's ignorant of what the right thing to do is, but he perseveres out of just sheer spiritedness or stubbornness, who's the most courageous? And at this point, Laches says, well, the stubborn man, the spirited man is most courageous. And he persists in this, even though Socrates says, well, what if he perseveres without knowledge? And Laches says he's still more courageous. And this is something very interesting about this argument. Because there's clearly something true about this. Yeah, there's got to be some element of sheer spiritedness, if you will, that's part of what it is to be courageous. It's not just a matter of knowledge and calculation. For instance, there's the movie Gattaca, which I covered in my film class, and I don't know if any of you have seen it. I know at least one of you. But in there, there's a contest between two brothers, one who's supposedly genetically inferior, who's the product of natural birth, and the other is the engineered offspring, one that the parents had made to their specifications. And they go swimming together, and they have a swimming contest, and the superior brother is so confident in his ability to win that he's totally taken aback when he loses. And years later, they redo the contest again, and it happens again. And the older brother, who is supposedly the inferior specimen, says, you know why I win? Because I don't save anything for the trip back. And that's brilliant, because what he's saying is, look, the supposedly superior brother is purely calculating, and he's calculating in terms of simply assuring his own survival and winning. So he's always saving, thinking about the trip back, right? And therefore there's a limit that he's not willing to transgress, namely he's not going to go beyond the point where he can return without assurance of safety. Whereas the other brother, out of sheer desire to win, is willing to risk his life over it. And this is spiritedness as opposed to rational calculation in this Platonic sense. He's willing to die in order to win. Honor is more important than life itself, right? Whereas the other brother is more concerned with life itself than honor. And that difference in character is enormously important. And part of what courage is has to be this willingness to be unsparing with one's life and to be uncalculating and imprudent in a certain way. When prudence and calculation and knowledge are a matter of self-preservation. And so when Laches says, well, wait a second here, the one who perseveres without knowledge and calculation is more courageous, there's some truth to that. Because part of what courage is being willing to risk something. And the calculating man is always calculating so that he doesn't really risk anything, or to minimize risks. And Socrates, though, ties him in knots, because he says, well, wait a second, didn't you say that foolish perseverance is not what courage is? But now you're saying that the perseverance of the foolish man is precisely what courage is. And poor Laches doesn't have an answer to that, and he's sort of tied in knots. And at this point, Nicias comes in. Nicias has a fairly intelligent approach to this thing. He's good at the question and answer thing. He's the smart guy, no question about it. His definition is based on something that he's heard Socrates say, which is near the bottom of 77, about 2, 4, 6 lines from the bottom. I've often heard you say that each of us is good in things in which he is wise, bad in those in which he is ignorant. Right? So goodness has to do with wisdom. Now, badness is not necessarily ignorance, but folly. And then Odysseus says that the courageous man is good. Since the courageous man is good, it's clear that he's wise. So you can't have folly and courage together, even though Laches ends up defending that claim. So courage is a kind of wisdom. This is said at the top of 78. This is revisited. Courage is a kind of wisdom, it's said. Later it's said to be a part of wisdom. And there's a difference between being a kind and being a part that we'll have to revisit. Then on 78, where it says 195A in the margin, there's a bit of a typographical problem here. It says SOC for Socrates, and then after that it says NIC. Just cross out the Socrates. It's Nicias who's speaking here. It's just some glitch with the way the thing was printed, and nobody caught that in the copy editing. It should say NIC. I say it's this, Laches, Nicias is saying. Knowledge of what things to fear and what to be confident about, both in war and everything else. That's his definition of wisdom. Knowledge of what things to fear and what to be confident about in war and everything else. And then Socrates elicits from him, look, knowledge of the things to fear is knowledge of the bad, and knowledge of the things to be confident about is knowledge of the good. So basically, what Nicias' definition of courage is knowledge of what's good and what's bad, both in war and in everything else. And this is an interesting definition. And clearly there has to be an element of knowing in courage. And for Plato and Aristotle, it turns out that discretion is the better part of virtue because every virtue consists at its core of a certain intellectual capacity to see the difference between what's good and bad. So to that extent, there is definitely an intellectual component to it. And what Nicias is bringing out is that intellectual component, that insight into what's good or bad. And Laches then comes in and says that, wait a second here, you can be wise but not courageous. You can be courageous but not wise. He wants to defend the separateness of virtues, whereas what's being done here is that courage is being defined as a kind of wisdom. And so they're the same, or they're one in some sense. And Nicias wants to say, no, they're not. Laches wants to say they're not one. And of course, Laches would be the kind of guy to think that, because he's the guy who's courageous but not honest. Now, what's wrong with the idea that a person can be courageous but not honest? What's wrong with the idea that you can have one virtue but not others? Well, Plato believes that the virtues have a kind of unity to them, such that if you've got one, you have to have all the others to really have one. Which means, in this case, that you can't really be courageous if you're a dishonest person. Why? Well, because part of what courage is going to be is courage to face the truth, or tell the truth, right? And if you're a liar, that's in part because you don't have the courage to tell the truth. And so your imperfection in the area of truth-telling is equivalent to an imperfection in courage. And the same can be done with all the other virtues. You can always find a case where the two virtues seem to be different and not necessarily connected, overlap with one another, and therefore are one in some sense. They might not be totally identical, but they certainly overlap. So it is not possible, in certain cases at least, to have one without having the other. And this is the famous thesis of the unity of virtue. And one of the most interesting parts of the Protagoras, which is the fourth dialogue in this book, is that it deals with that issue in great detail. The Protagoras is one of the longer Platonic dialogues where Plato is, where Socrates is conversing with the great sophist Protagoras. And Protagoras he is portrayed as a splendid figure, a formidable intellectual. And actually, something that Plato and Socrates would both approve of, something of a highly articulate conservative.
Laches isn't totally dishonest ever just because he's lied once or twice and stolen a little bit of money.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not totally dishonest. No. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's got to be a degree that counts, right? I mean...
Well... It might be the case that there is a person who's never told a lie, but is basically dishonest, because the principle that they operate on is something like this: I'll tell the truth whenever it's convenient. That's not an honest person. Right? I'll tell the truth whenever it's advantageous. That's not really an honest person. Or I'll steal only when it's advantageous. And they might go through life never having stolen or lied simply because there was no opportunity for them that met their criteria. Now, on the surface, that's an honest person. But deep down inside, they're a dishonest person, because the principle that they operate on is one of dishonesty. So in that sense, you could say that it's really not a matter of degree, it's a matter of kind. Lockies might be the kind of person who operated on that principle. That, look, I'll keep people's trust and I'll shepherd their money, unless, of course, it's advantageous to me to steal it, in which case I'll steal it. And he might have not had many opportunities to do that, but when he did, he availed himself of it. And so he didn't maybe commit a lot of wrongs, but the basic principle he operated on was to wrong people. And in that way, you could say that his character is that of a dishonest man. However, it might also be the case that a person who's basically an honest person and who accepts the principle that you should always keep your word might break their word. Why? Because they don't realize it in some way. Or they're frightened, right? They lose their nerve. Momentary bit of folly or madness hits them. In which case, you could say that they have sinned, right? But can you really say that they're a rotten person? No. Their basic principle seems to be correct, but their behavior seems to fail. Just like a person could kill somebody, but not necessarily be a killer. What is a killer? A killer is a person who will kill if it's advantageous and they can get away with it. Even if they never do that, morally they're a murderer in some sense. That's the principle they'll operate on. Whereas a person might, in a fit of passion or anger or folly, commit a murder, but you might not say that that person is a murderer. You might say they're a manslaughterer or something like that, or... You know, it's third degree or whatever. This is why we have these different degrees, because part of what first degree murder is really pointing to is the fact that there's some deep principle about that person that allows them to kill. They thought it out. They're acting on a principle of a murderer, and therefore they're more likely to do it again. Right? If somebody's mad and has it in for their mother, well, they're not a danger to anybody else but the mother. But if somebody is just basically the kind of person who'd kill anybody because they think they can get away with it and it's advantageous, then in principle they're far more dangerous. And that's why they, in some ways, make these sort of fine distinctions. But it's not so much a distinction of degree as a distinction of fundamentally different kinds of principles that people act on, even though they call it first, second, or third degree, right, in case of murders. The whole discussion with Nicias and his definition of wisdom, very interesting, because it's always sliding back and forth between understanding courage as a kind of wisdom and understanding courage as a kind of techne or art, which is the common thing that Plato's always oscillating between. And it's very interesting how Lockes and Socrates both, but particularly Lockes, insist on treating wisdom as an art. And Nicias always sidesteps this. He's very clever. His views are very Socratic. And he's very clever at getting around these problems. So, for instance, Lockes and Socrates say to Nicias, wait a second here. How is this definition of a courageous man different from any art? For instance, the art of a doctor. Doesn't a doctor know what's good or bad? Doesn't a sheepherder or any other practitioner of an art know what the good and the bad is? And Nicias says, no, they only know their art. The doctor knows what makes a person sick and what makes a person well, but the doctor doesn't know which of these is to be feared, meaning he doesn't know which of these is the better fate. He knows how to cure and he knows how to kill, but he's not the person to decide which is the better condition for a person to be in. And that's what wisdom is. purpose. It's knowledge of the right outcome, not knowledge of how to bring things about, which is technical knowledge. This is sort of ironic. Lockes talks about the seer. You know, and this, of course, is Nicias' downfall following the advice of soothsayers. Basically, Lockes says, Nicias, your definition of courage is that of a soothsayer, foreseeing things that are good and bad, right? Nicias says, no, there's a difference. The soothsayer can tell you what's going to happen and what's not going to happen, but it's for the wise man to know whether these things are good or bad. And it's kind of funny. He's totally convinced that these seers can give you this information, which is his downfall. But he at least recognizes that it falls not to the art of the soothsayer, but to the art of the wise person, not an art, but wisdom itself, to determine which is the good and which is the bad outcome, which is a sound Socratic point. Nicias is holding his own. Then they have a little discussion about courage and fearlessness. This is on page 80. And again, Nicias holds his own very nicely. Basically, one of the arguments that's made is, look, if courage is a kind of wisdom, then what happens is we can't say that animals are courageous. Lions and boars and other things, because they're not wise. And Nicias says, that's fine. I wouldn't call a lion courageous, just as I wouldn't call a child courageous. They may be fearless because they're ignorant. Whereas to be courageous, you have to be wise, which requires a certain kind of knowledge, a certain kind of intellectual insight. But what's being left out there, though, is this fact that there is something to courage, that there is something about courage that's lion-like or boar-like. It's this sheer animal ferocity and spiritedness that is being left out of here with this purely intellectual account that Nicias is giving. So Lockes is still bringing out something important. It's not just some kind of anthropomorphic folly or fantasy by which we call lions courageous. There's something real about the lion spiritedness that's part of what we mean by courage in a human being, too. And then the last argument that's given, which is a kind of weird and disappointing argument, is basically this. Nicias initially asserts that courage is a kind of wisdom, meaning that wisdom is a sort of larger category and that courage is one of the things that would fall into it. Socrates, when he reformulates this issue at the bottom of 81, formulates it in terms of courage being a part of wisdom, which is different. Why is it different? Well, to say that courage is a kind of wisdom is to say that wisdom is a category with separate parts in it. But to say that courage is part of wisdom is to say that wisdom is a whole, and there are just different aspects of it. So to say that courage is a kind of wisdom is to say that it's something on its own, it's substantial, but it belongs to a larger category. To say that it's part of wisdom is to say that it's insubstantial, that it's just an aspect of one larger whole. And then what Socrates basically does is he just gets Lockes to admit that wisdom is simply knowledge of what's good and bad. And if courage is knowledge of what's good and bad, then courage is the same as wisdom. It can't be part of it. It can't be a kind of it. It just is wisdom, which is a very peculiar notion. He wants to maintain that it's somehow separate, whether as a part or as a kind. But Socrates gets him maneuvered around into saying that it's basically one and the same thing, that wisdom and courage are the same. Now, Nicias doesn't really have any way out of this. And so he basically gives up. One way out of it, though, is to say that they are all the same, but that what courage is wisdom applied to a certain situation, whereas temperance is wisdom applied to another situation. And so, in themselves, the virtues are one. They're all just aspects or faces of wisdom, but they're differentiated not in terms of their inner structure, but in terms of the different things that they deal with. So Aristotle, for instance, believes strongly in the unity of virtue. And his account of the difference between courage and temperance is simple. Courage has to do with the painful and fearful. Temperance with the pleasurable. But they're one and the same insofar as they're both wisdom. They're both right use or right response to these different things. And insofar as they deal with different things, you could call them by different names, but in themselves they're all one and the same. They're simply this power of right use or right response manifesting itself in all these different ways. That's the kind of way that you can handle this problem. Socrates doesn't suggest this, and Nicias doesn't think of it. But that's one way you can deal with it if you follow Aristotle. At the end, what happens is Socrates basically just
clams up.
The generals and the fathers all agree. They're gentlemen. There's a little bit of rancor and snappiness between Nicias and Laches. But at the end, gentlemen that they are, they all agree that they're incapable of deciding the matter. And they're incapable of educating their children. They're totally convinced by Socrates that they need to know what courage is. And they're totally convinced that they're incapable of giving an account of it. And therefore they say, Socrates, we need your help. You need to teach us. And it's kind of charming. It's wonderful to see these men who are so accomplished, but yet so lacking in vanity that they're actually willing to admit that they're wrong. Other of Socrates' conversation partners are not that way. They're filled with vanity and rancor, and they'll never admit that they made a mistake. These guys are real gentlemen about it. They know their limits. Knowing your limits is one form of self-knowledge that's very much a part of Socratic wisdom. Then they demand a teacher. And Socrates says, I can't teach you. So we're going to have to find a teacher for us. And he agrees to meet with them the next day to discuss this. And that's the end of the dialogue. And the premise that's sort of left there hanging at the end that needs to be questioned is exactly how does one acquire wisdom? Is it taught? Or is it acquired some other way? If it can be taught, then we need to find an expert who can teach it to us. Socrates is always very careful when he talks about experts in philosophy to say, if there is such a person, then we must find them. He's always leaving open the possibility, which I think he believes sincerely, that there are no experts like this who can simply teach it to us. But yet, it is the most needful thing of all. If we're concerned about happiness, if we're concerned about well-being, then we have to learn how to make right use of all the things that have been given to us, all the advantages and disadvantages that have been given to us by fortune. That's what wisdom allows us. Since we're all concerned with happiness, it's the thing that we most need, yet it's the thing that we can't be taught. So how do we find it? Well, one answer might be to engage in the kind of Socratic dialectic that you see shown in the dialogues. Socrates doesn't teach, but he certainly sows the seeds of teachings in all of these people that he meets, right? And sometimes this bears fruit. He causes them to raise questions. He causes them to feel insecure, anxious, to worry about virtue, to worry about perfection, to worry about excellence. And he gives them a lot of food for thought, and one hopes that through the questioning that you see in the dialogues, but also the privacy of their own minds, that that's going to bear fruits. And if this is the way that you can learn to be wise, then Plato's dialogues are the absolute perfect instruments for doing that. Not because they teach you, but because they engage your mind and they provide you with a situation where you can draw things from the depths of your own soul. And with that, I think that's as fitting a way of fitting a speech as any to sort of wrap this whole class up.
Well spoken.
Excellent.
So if you want to be wise, read Plato. He won't teach you, but you'll find that you learn nonetheless.